Accession number 21564, rail 27.
Colonel Cormack, rail 27. You were saying that the spigot mortar, which had been on the petard tank, had been retained post-war.
That was a very effective charge. The nickname was the flying dustbin, and it was just a mortar, really with a spring-loaded thing, if you like, that would hurl this charge reasonably accurately for 50 to perhaps 200 or 300 yards, depending on the ground and the wind and the weather. But it was ideal for knocking out pillboxes and strong points like that. Because of its shorter range, it was perhaps more effective in some cases than the artillery support might have been. But it was very much liked. It was so a powerful charge. And it lasted with the assault engineers, later the armoured engineers, for quite a few years after the war, particularly on the Churchill tank. I think when the armoured engineers eventually changed to the Centurion tanks, then they, for some reason, I know not, the spigot mortar was left abandoned and was not proceeded with. But I think it was about a 6.5-inch diameter or something of that nature charge, which we thought was very effective, but the powers that be at the time thought that the range of this charge and so on was not compatible with modern battlefields, and it was never reintroduced.
Mm. Now, it was often used in combination with the Crocodile, which was a Churchill fitted with a flamethrower.
That was a very effective weapon. The Soviet Army kept it on much longer. I mean, they may still have it, for all I know, but than we did. But whether we dropped it on grounds of on humanitarian grounds or some such, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But for any strong point like that, one shot of that through the or over the obstacle and into the sort of firing holes or whatever was enough usually to either wipe the crew out or cause them to surrender. Mm-hmm. It was used by the Americans a lot, I know, in the war in the Far East against the Japanese on various islands like Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and Guadalcanal, because the Japanese were not inclined to surrender for their own particular beliefs at the time. And even when they were burnt to bits with these flamethrowers, it still took a lot of wheedling out, but they were nevertheless very effective. Mm-hmm. But again, we don't use them now. Not quite sure why, but perhaps again it goes against the idea of where we fight nowadays.
There are other things like bobbin tanks, which were used for laying mats over soft ground and things like that. Do you remember if those were considered for resurrection? Yes. And revival?
They are in existence today, a modified form. And at the same time, well, actually it was just before I was in OR7, we were experimenting with this trackway. There was class 30, which would take all the vehicles in a battle group, if you like, except tanks. It would take tanks for a short distance, for a short time. But the idea was that you came to a gap crossing site, and by the very nature of a river bank or whatever, there was a lot of soft soil or mud on the bank. And frequently, as sappers, we had to position truckloads, tipper truckloads, with hardcore. And if things got difficult, or in anticipation of difficulty, the first thing you had to do was to send these vehicles forward and tip the hardcore onto the crossing site so that your vehicles could drive over the mud and so on. But then you had the problem of getting out the other side, where you couldn't, in advance of the operation, tip the hardcore. So from that, and from the experience during the last war, this trackway was developed. And it was on a class 30, aluminium strips locked together into a very flexible roll, which could be spread out like that. And again, the technology, the metallurgy we were talking about in the Medium-Girder Bridge comes into play. This material was quite strong, flexible, and quite light. And it was mounted on the front of 3-ton trucks, or 4-ton trucks as we have now, on a spool. And you had to line the truck up, because the driver couldn't see once he started to lay the track as it went over the front and he drove it out. And once he was lined up, he simply went straight forward, and it was on a great big drum, and it rolled out, and at the end it just flipped out, and then he would reverse back. It was never pegged down, or it could be if necessary, but it wasn't usually. And then the crossing vehicles could run through and get into the water and get out again, and you could, with difficulty, lay it on the far bank, on a shorter strip perhaps, on a tank. You could mount it on a tank, and if you drop it on the far bank, that was possible later on. But that was a development, and it was exceptionally good. And you could use it in other cases, cross-country movement, not necessarily the river crossing, where the ground was boggy and soft, where in the old days we had to use improvised materials or summer felt tracking or lay timber balks down, all time-consuming and cumbersome. This trackway could be laid to cover that very, very quickly. And it could be picked up again, although that was much more difficult because it usually had mud and soil ingrained and therefore heavier. But it could be recovered.
So you could roll it up and then use it again somewhere else.
You could do that. You hose it down, pick it up and roll it or whatever, and it could be used again. Following on from the Class 30 trackway, we developed the Class 60 trackway, which was more of a mat and had to be laid in a different way, but that was strong enough to allow tanks coming along to a river crossing site where they might come at an angle and then had to skew round, and that inevitably churned up the soil. You could lay your mat to cover that area, the tank could come along, turn on the matting without any disruption of the soil, without any interruption to the flow of normal traffic over it, and get your tank through. That was a useful thing, and it could be carried on the tanks as well. And from that, again, then came a similar sort of trackway or landing mat for the Harrier aircraft.
Well, were these mats made of wire mesh, or were they metal?
It was, strips of this aluminium alloy metal, which were linked together as a continuous strip, and it was ridged to give you the extra grip. That was the thing. And it could be made longer or shorter, but that was a cumbersome business. You tended to use the length on the roll, or having laid one strip, the truck would back off, another one would come, and it was a little overlap, could lay another strip. It was useful, flexible, and very effective. But these were all, it was another development really, from the bobbin tank. As equipments and materials change, as technology improves, some ideas like that were modified and carried on.
And one thing that seems to have happened in more recent times is that quite a lot of material of that sort that used to be metal is now made of plastic.
Lighter and quite strong.
Yeah.
But we were not at that time, the sort of early 70s, thinking of using, well, at least we weren't, thinking of using plastic in that way.
So it's before that stage then?
Yes.
Because I think they now have plastic fascines, don't they? Bundles of plastic piping, which is used as a fascine.
That was coming in again. Yeah.
For filling ditches mainly.
Yes. The old idea was a bundle of brushwood, quite simply.
Yes.
Which you carry on the front of the APC. And as you got to the gap, you blew a little charge, and the fascine, the bundle of, rolled into the ditch, and you would put one in or two or three in as the gap dictated, and then you could drive across. Yes, that certainly was being changed into rolls of very strong but flexible plastic tubing. Yes, I can remember that. That was coming in, certainly. But that, I think, was the only particular one of that material that I remember, but it certainly was much lighter than the bundles of brushwood other similar material we used to use.
Well, brushwood goes back to the 16th century, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Elizabethan times.
The very name of fascine gives its historical background, yes.
It sounds like you had a very happy time when you were in OR7.
It was very, very enjoyable doing that, yes. It was an interregnum, if you like. But it was a very nice way of not filling in gaps, but of being employed. And it was my only experience of working in the MOD, which was something I had tried to avoid all my career, and quite successfully. But that was enjoyable.
Did you actually have to spend a lot of time in the MOD, or were you more out on the ground and up in Leeds with the ROF?
It was about 60% in the office and 40% out, which made it even better.
I mean, when you were in the office, did you have routine working hours, office hours, or were you in and out as required?
Oh, it was pretty well getting down to the paperwork. Was you got in by a train. I was usually in about 9 o'clock-ish, coming up from Chatham, and then I would leave as the workload required. About 5 o'clock, I would think of getting a train home, but if something bobbed up, it might be 6 o'clock before I got home. The hours were pretty fixed, but there was a certain flexibility. But you simply had to get the thing done, and there was a pressing need to get the main job, which was the combat engineer tractor, underway. So it was worth a few extra hours here and there.
You mentioned doing the paperwork. Was on the whole, do you think your work was done primarily on paper, or was it done verbally in meetings or on the telephone?
A lot of paperwork, but a lot of meetings and consultations and visits, talking over and looking at the thing in discussions. Yes, with the two main areas were Christchurch and Leeds, and often I went up on my own or had someone with me. We could discuss things in the train. Make use of the time that way. But it was an interesting project, and one was very anxious to see it through to fruition.
How was it that you went to Northag then? What brought about that?
Well, it was a routine job.
Was it something in which you'd expressed an interest, going to headquarters, Northern Army
Group? No, quite the reverse. It was something quite different from what I had asked, but then that's usually par for the course.
What had you asked for?
I would have liked to have been a defence attaché somewhere in Eastern Europe, using my Brixmas experience and so on. I wouldn't have minded going to Moscow. These would have been jobs that I would have liked, but that's not the way. And I suggested that, and so perhaps I wasn't too surprised to get something quite different. But it resulted in I was based in Holland. Was running a small team. It was a 23 liaison group, as it was called.
Yes.
And it was a development of the idea that Montgomery had during the last war of having liaison people with the main formations that he was working. And he had these very distinguished young liaison officers, many of whom were all had battle experience, and some very distinguished battle experience, and most of whom did extremely well afterwards. And from that, Northag thought that with the variety of troops at his disposal, we had a Dutch corps, a Belgian corps, and yes, that was it. And we had one with the Americans. The French, we had our normal defense attaché system set up because they were in NATO but not part of it, if you like.
They weren't in the integrated command structure.
They were not at all, no. They came to exercises as observers and were taking more interest in it, but they were still having de Gaulle having pulled them out. That's the way they stayed. So we had one in Belgium, one in Holland, and we had a big one with the German army, and then one with the Americans at Absent.
How many people were there actually in your little team, 23rd Liaison Group?
Just 3 or 4.
And who
I was on my own. I had. Yes. A clerk, assistant, and a driver, and my own car to give me mobility. And really what I was there was to make friends, if you like, with the Dutch Corps and their staff, get to know them, make myself known, and help them or where they needed help to say, this is what ComNorthag is thinking at the moment, in an unofficial sort of way, getting to know how they operated and how they worked. Because when we came to do NORTHAG exercises, I would be living with the Dutch Corps headquarters. And then I would make regular visits to ComNorthag. There were headquarters exercises, not exactly chutes, but where we would actually go and stay and work in the bunkers down at Maastricht, where ComNorthag's underground headquarters was. Mm. And then we would work there closely together. And I had to get to know the ComNorthag staff, who they were and how they were thinking, what they were doing. And generally making contact between the two as easy as possible, apart from the official, general official lines. I also did quite a lot of work helping Dutch officers further their career by improving their English. And they were all extremely, which didn't do any good for my Dutch, I have to say. We arrived, of course, Beverly learned some Dutch as well, and were every hopes that we would become quite fluent in Dutch. And we started off that way, but more and more people would drop into my office for a chat and to practice their English, because for the Belgians and the Dutch and the Germans, a prerequisite for a staff job at NATO or NORTHAG was fluency in English. And I got to know the people very well that way, but it didn't do my Dutch any good.
Who did you report to at NORTHAG?
I reported directly to ComNorthag, but as a matter of routine, I would go and see him every time I went down. But in detail, I went to the chief of staff, G3,
yes.
All the chief of staff, and occasionally I had to do with G2, ACOS G3, ACOS G2, mostly ACOS G3.
How often did you report? Did you report in daily or weekly?
I would go down once a month.
Yes.
That's what I mean, the phone calls, and there were telexes in those days. Mm. It was before the days of fax machines or internets, but telexes were available. That sort of thing, and then I visit once a month in person. Mm. And in between, I visited, not only got to know the Dutch Corps headquarters, I made a point of visiting all their divisions and all their brigades. And some of the, when I had time or when I was asked, I could always ask formally that I would like to visit such and such a division.
Yes.
And was made very welcome. And I would then, having seen the divisional commander, I would say I would like to visit his brigade commanders. I was always made very welcome. And then it was suggested that perhaps I might go and see a particular unit in action. And the engineer training school were very keen for me to visit there and see what they were doing as an engineer. And so life was pretty full that way, getting to know them.
Just going round, using your eyes and ears, and just getting to know people.
And they had all their troops were in Holland except one brigade at Hona. Mm-hmm. They had one on the spot. And then I then visited them several times and watched them firing and just saw them at Hona. But of course, the great concern seeing how they planned to move their troops from Holland to their positions in their divisional area in Beauvoir.
Dutch officers themselves often expressed concern about whether or not they would be able to get forward into their general deployment plan area if the balloon went up. And they tended to say that the reason that they were deployed in the Netherlands rather than over the border in Germany was a financial one and a political one rather than an operational one.
Ideally, they should have been forward in Beauvoir as we were.
Yes.
But it was politics and economics, I think, were the reason. Probably more politics that they kept them back. But there certainly was one brigade at Hona, or the central part of a brigade at Hona. But it was always a concern. Would the trains run as planned?
Exactly.
And would the columns going by road, would they get through as planned?
Well,
that
there
was
be
a concern.
those routes forward would be a prime target for Spetsnaz operations, wouldn't
they?
Yes,
they would, yes. Mm. Who would almost certainly know exactly which routes they were on and where the nodal points were that disruption would cause the maximum damage.
And presumably they could operate by demolition and by ambush.
Yes. Yeah, it wouldn't take much to destroy a railway system like that.
Did the Dutch have plans for counteracting that kind of disruptive operation?
If they did, I wasn't party to that. Mm. I know that they had other forces available to NATO, and they had a marine amphibious brigade, which they had was able to be used in the rear areas to land on coastal areas to intervene at certain points. I know they practiced that.
Mm. You mentioned going to the field, their headquarters. Were their headquarters organised on the same sort of basis as ours were?
Yes, we were all, by that time, we were all on the you might call the unified staff system, G1, G2, G3, G4, G5. Mm. We were just at that time in the business of getting rid of brigade majors and DAQMGs and GSO3s and so on, and staff captains. But that was a simplification. I think we were all very sorry to see these traditional titles go, but it made it very much easier to know that a chap in G3, he was the operational tactics man, G2 was intelligence and so on. It did make it much easier to work in together. And they were always very keen to be cooperative. At the same time, there was all that feeling that they liked to do it their own way. Right. That was certainly true. But I had the impression that it would work very well, that they, particularly with the Dutch, and I think the Belgians were the same, the aim was to make sure we were one team and do the NATO job as we planned to do with the least possible friction.
How did their way differ from our way? What were the characteristics of the Dutch way as you observed them?
Well, it was a national service army for a start, which we had got rid of, and they were still national service in my day. They were toying with the idea of becoming an all-regular army, but they had considerable difficulties because their population base wasn't all that big, and they weren't quite sure they would get enough volunteers to man. But I think they were moving that way in years ahead. So that was a problem. And then you had the social aspect of Holland. They were a liberally minded country, very independently minded people, and they had to be very careful about applying a strict military discipline. I mean, we had the joke of the long-haired Dutch conscripts with hair nets for operating in tanks. I mean, that was a well-known sort of talking point. They had a strong trade union influence. They had an officers' union and they had soldiers' unions, and they had officers represented on the union, and so you had that aspect. I don't think it affected them very much. It may have been quite good for their particular terms of pay and pensions and working conditions. I don't really feel that the unions would have an impact on their operational effectiveness. But there was always that thought, and I can come back to that later on in my time. But that obviously would have an impact on the way they operated. They had to take that into account. But they were very keen. Their military academy at Breda, their Sandhurst, if you like, was very well run, and the officers came up very well trained. They sent officers, they had their own staff course. They sent officers to Camberley. They sent officers to the American college at Leavenworth, their higher tactics school there. And they came out with good grades and good marks, if you like. And they were the ones who were clearly earmarked to become battalion commanders, brigade commanders, and so on. Yes, they were keen to do well.
Did they have a distinctive operational style?
Not particularly, no. They were very much more thinking or operating on the American lines than ours. One had that impression. And their equipment was, again, a mixture of American, but was, by the time I was there, very largely German.
It's interesting because during the Second World War, the Dutch army was defeated very rapidly in 1940. And then when the Free Dutch Forces were being formed, the primary influence on them was British.
Yes.
Most of them were actually trained in British depots and by British regiments.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. But that influence changed. Yeah. American influence became strong. And then I would say, from the equipment point of view and tactics, the German influence was very strong. Mm. In spite of the fact that most of them spoke English and very good English.
Mm. And there also appears to be still, even to this day, in the Netherlands, quite a strong anti-German feeling.
Yes, it's less. When I was there, a very nice German officer was appointed to be a German liaison officer. He was the first, Gunther, I forget his name. He just commanded a tank regiment in the German army, and he was setting up a liaison headquarters with the Dutch in the same way we had done for years. And I got to know him very well, and we liked him, and we had social contact. He lived much nearer the German border than I did in Apeldoorn, and occasionally they stayed with us. I think he had a harder row to hoe than I did to begin with, but because he was a good bloke, he was accepted and got on with the job. The older people of my generation and those who were slightly older who'd been actively in the war, who'd lived throughout the war in Holland, they were very reluctant to come to terms with modern Germany. They were doing so, but with reluctance. Mm. The youngsters, those of the same age as my children, took a much more pragmatic view, were much more open and saying, let's get on with things. So the attitude over the years, as the generations go, will change in that direction. But the youngsters, the teenagers, the 20-year-olds, the post-war, we're very much more pragmatic. Let's get on with life. And we're all part of Europe. They had this European idea much more strongly than would appear to be the case in this country.
One of the aspects of the Dutch forces that British officers often found alarming was the fact that they insisted upon exercising the right to free speech, writing letters to the newspapers, for example. And in particular, in round about this time, the Commandant at Breda, General van Meenveld, was writing a column in a leading newspaper criticising NATO's increasing dependence on nuclear weapons. Do you remember?
Yes. That was quite noticeable that they played a part in politics. Mm. We've had a tradition, as you know, of we don't talk about politics or ladies in the mess, and we were not a political organisation. The Dutch were very political, and they made it quite clear which way they were voting and what they thought should be done, and they were not at all backward in coming forward to criticise things. And there were some cases where people resigned on principle. I don't think it did a great deal of harm to anybody or anything, but it was a noticeable thing that they felt free to say in public and write in public what they thought.
Well, I think they would argue that it actually made them stronger because their differences of opinion were out in the open, and General van Meenveld could express his view of the nuclear issue.
Yes, in public.
In public. And then officers who were under his command on the staff at the Academy at Breda could express an entirely contrary opinion in public and have it published. Mm. And neither side really thought anything of it.
No, and they could form their own views and perhaps modify their views accordingly. It just didn't seem to